and they come in and they said, we were over at the dredge and we pulled a pulley and it got out of control and it started a fire.
A piece of Alaska's mining history is lost to fire. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Susitna Watana Dam opponents want FERC to explain recent decisions.
FERC rejected that recommendation by their own panel, and the reasons that they did are what we're trying to uncover.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
A small plane crashed on takeoff from a remote beach in Katmai National Park and Preserve last evening. Federal accident investigators say the Cessna 206 with six on board were operated by Homer-based K Bay Air. No injuries were reported in the accident. The plane went down in the surf, according to the National Transportation Safety Board. No word yet on how the pilot and passengers got out of the plane. Rebecca Talbot, a public affairs officer with the National Park Service in Anchorage, says the plane's operator is a permittee of the Park Service. She says right now there is some confusion about where the crash occurred.
We have not had an official report of the accident from K Bay Air. We have only heard informal reports, and it has not yet been determined if it was at Cape Douglas or Kamishak Bay.
Talbot says weather in the park is deteriorating and no Park Service personnel are near the crash site. The head of the NTSB's Anchorage office, Clint Johnson, says investigators have not yet interviewed the pilot and don't know details such as the extent of damage to the plane. The cause of the crash is also unknown. The Alaska Permanent Fund has posted its highest year-ending balance with a value of $44.9 billion. The fund reported an average return of 10.5% for the year ending June 30th. Michael Burns, CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, says it was a very good year for stocks, which comprise the biggest segment of the fund's assets. The fund expects to transfer $604 million to the dividend division for checks this year. That would be the lowest transfer since fiscal year 2005. The amount of investment earnings allocated to dividends is based on a five-year rolling average of permanent fund performance. That average includes 2009, when the fund posted its first net loss. Fairbanks is mourning the loss of a piece of mining history. Gold dredge number 3 off the Steese Highway in Chattanooga burned Saturday. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Two men reported the fire to the Chattanooga Lodge, which is across the Steese Highway from the old gold dredge. Lodge waitress Monica Butterfield says the men said they'd climbed into the dredge and accidentally started the fire while playing with machinery.
My boss was cooking, I was waiting tables, and they come in and they said, we were over at the dredge and we pulled a pulley and it got out of control and it started a fire.
Butterfield says the men, who did not give their names, said they tried to put out the flames with their water bottles. She says the lodge cook ran across with a bucket of water and a fire extinguisher, but the blaze was already out of control. She says fire departments from Fairbanks responded. No flames escaped the dredge, which is surrounded by water and tailings. Gold Dredge number 3 is owned by Jane and Chris Haig and Patty Pearsall of Fairbanks. Pearsall says they bought the dredge in 1997 to preserve it, but signs never deterred people from climbing into the 200-foot-long, 5-story-high structure.
That in one way was the wonderfulness about it, that people actually could walk across the tailings and see it. Of course, that's also the unfortunate part, that people, rather than just staying on the tailings and looking at it, went on it and, in this case, destroyed it.
Pearsall says the dredge was not insured, and she's not sure what's next given the extent of damage done by the fire.
The superstructure is still there. All although some of it, well, the main mast is bent, which means that there was some really powerful things happening. The main conveyor is lying on the ground. The gantry is in the water. And it looks pretty sad.
Pearsall says the dredge operated for 30 years, digging a mile of gold-rich gravel a year until 1962. She says the dredge, which sits in the canal it dug, is one of the largest in the interior and was one of just a few intact. Pearsall says she and the Hagues have not decided about whether they'll try to restore the dredge, but are requesting an investigation of the fire's cause. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Warm, windy weather fueled wildfire activity around the interior over the weekend, including a new human-caused fire off the Steese Highway north of Fairbanks. The Long Creek Fire near Mile 47 started Saturday afternoon. Alaska Division of Forestry spokesman Jim Schwarber says air tankers spotted the smoke while en route to the Gold Dredge Fire.
When they arrived at the dredge scene by flying over, they noticed that the dredge itself was engulfed in flames but was not posing a direct threat to the wildland, and the priority switched to checking out this additional smoke column further down the road that was adjacent to a rural subdivision and a few residents.
Schwarber says air tankers were able to attack the blaze early on, which enabled firefighters to minimize the amount of growth despite dangerous weather conditions.
The first load of retardant was dropped across the head of that fire when it was still probably just 15 acres in size or smaller, and very quick initial response on that fire because it was burning in some black spruce on a slope with a south wind, and conditions were ripe for that fire to grow quickly.
The fire was stopped at about 84 acres. The cause of the Long Creek Fire is under investigation. Crews are fighting wildfires in the Copper River Valley that were started by lightning strikes last week. Fires near Excelsior Creek and Talbert Lake were started on July 31st. The Excelsior Creek fire is still burning, but there hasn't been any significant growth, while the Talbert Fire near Lake Louise has grown to about 20 acres. Fires near Clearwater and Moose Creeks have grown since they started on August 1st. Both fires are currently around 1 acre. No fire bans have been issued, but those in the area are advised to be careful when starting other fires, such as campfires. A fire last week destroyed one of the last two large milling operations in Wrangell. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver has this update.
Nobody was injured in the blaze. The fire started in the mid-afternoon at the sawmill at 13 miles Imovia Highway. The mill is owned and operated by Mike Allen of Mike Allen Enterprises. Spotty cell phone service and distance made responding to the blaze a challenge. That portion of Zamovia Highway was under heavy construction and closed down to a single lane with pilot vehicles. Secon, the company doing the construction, was the first to respond, sending up one of its tankers. Secon workers jumped into action, helping emergency responders get to the fire by directing traffic and getting other vehicles off the road. The fire department sent its tankers, trucks, and volunteer crew out. It took around 6 hours and a lot of work to put out the fire. Fire Chief Tim Buness says sawmill fires can be tricky because of all of the wood products.
Part of the issue was getting all of the little sawdust hot spots put out. There was quite a bit of sawdust that was around the mill. So we had these little spot fires that kept cropping back up that we had to put out.
Buness says the cause of the fire is still unknown, but an investigation is underway.
We have forwarded our reports to the State Fire Marshal's office, as we would for standard reporting on any type of fire like that.
Wrangell was once a power in the timber industry, but as economic tides changed, the larger mills closed. Mike Allen's sawmill was one of the last two substantial local milling operations in town. It specialized in custom milling and rough-cut lumber, and most of Allen's business was local. Allen and his wife Angela were both there to watch the firefighters fight the blaze. The Allen family does not wish to comment at this point in time, but in a Facebook post on a Wrangell page, Angela wrote, "Thank you to all the firefighters for being out there, doing everything you could to get the fire out." Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, passing the time when stuck in a tent on a rainy day.
Can you do a sun dance?
Yeah.
Okay, do a Sundance.
Oh, I want to see a Sundance.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Opponents of the Susitna Dam have asked the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to release documents explaining their decision not to require in-depth climate change studies. KTNA's Philip Manning has the story.
An attorney representing the Coalition for Susitna Dam Alternatives sent the letter to FERC on Thursday. The National Marine Fisheries Service wants FERC to require extensive studies on the impact of climate change regarding the Susitna-Watana hydroelectric project. FERC denied the request and has already been asked to release documents related to their decision, but claims that the requested documents are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. FERC cited a lack of data reliability and cost as contributing to their decision. Richard Leo is the president of the Coalition for Susitna Dam Alternatives and says that the goal of their appeal is to determine the details that influence FERC's decision.
FERC had established a panel of experts to consider this question. And those experts concluded that the climate change studies were a good idea to do it in comprehensive detail. FERC rejected that recommendation by their own panel. And the reasons that they did are what we're trying to uncover.
The Alaska Energy Authority is the state corporation tasked with the Susitna Dam. Wayne Dyock is the project manager for the dam and says that AEA intends to conduct a portion of the studies requested by the Fisheries Service, even if they will not be required by FERC.
They're asking us to look at a literature search only. AEA has elected to do a climate change study for the region upstream of the Watana Dam, primarily because we want to understand how the glacial melt might affect runoff over the next 100 years, because that is our fuel source. And it is a very sophisticated model that we're undertaking. And I believe it's very consistent with what the National Marine Fisheries Service would like the Alaska Energy Authority to undertake.
Dyock says the primary distinction between AEA and the Fisheries Service plans is that AEA does not intend to conduct the same type of detailed modeling downstream of the dam site. He says there have been follow-up meetings with the Fisheries Service to address their concerns. The Susitna Dam has encountered some setbacks this summer, most notably from Alaska Native corporations who have not issued permits for land access for many of the 58 environmental impact studies. Richard Leo says this means more time and money.
It seems increasingly clear that the studies will not be done in 2 years, but require at least 3 years to complete, thus delaying the entire process of the dam and requiring more expense to find out what the effects of the dam are actually going to be.
Wayne Dyock says that discussions are ongoing with the Alaska Native corporations, but there should be no delays to the study timeline.
We want to work with the Alaska Native landowners. We have some work to do there to gain access, but we developed a plan, a contingency plan this year if we did not have that access that would allow us to stay on the schedule.
The studies are part of a licensing process that takes years to complete. After all of the environmental impact studies are finished, FERC will decide whether or not to permit the dam to be built. AEA's time frame calls for preliminary licensing to begin in September of 2015. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
A family of outdoor adventurers from Seldovia has completed their latest epic adventure. Aaron McKittrick and Brett Wood Higman, joined by 4-year-old Katmai and 2-year-old Latuya, hiked and pack-raft more than 800 miles around the entirety of Cook Inlet. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
The Higman-McKittrick family started its long journey around Cook Inlet back in March, when winter was only beginning to loosen its grip and a world of snow and ice was making way for water. The crusty edges of ice along the beaches of Ketchumak Bay made a fun game for 4-year-old Katmai, who raced with his dad running along and smashing the ice into the ground.
And you're, what are you again?
A blubberosaurus.
A blubberosaurus? They have such a funny way of running.
Why?
I don't know. You're the blubberosaurus. You could tell me.
And what exactly is a blubberosaurus? Well, in the mind of Katmai, it's apparently a type of dinosaur that enjoys trotting along precarious ice shelves. McKittrick says that keeping the kids entertained and the traveling fun was the key to being able to cover such a great distance with a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Oh, they had a great time. I mean, because a 4-year-old was kind of our limiting factor, we designed a trip that was, you know, pretty much ideal for a 4-year-old. You know, he got to relax when we were paddling in the raft, and he got to run and walk on the beach, and both the kids got to spend lots and lots of time just playing on all kinds of different beaches.
When we last checked in with the family, they were just about to depart from Anchorage, transitioning from the populated east side of Cook Inlet to the west side.
Yeah, you start going down the west side and, you know, pretty soon there's far, far more brown bears than people. And a lot of just really, you know, incredible coastline and waterfalls and just basically all that kind of gorgeous wilderness.
There were, of course, some people on the west side, including families of Cook Inlet set netters, inhabitants of the village of Tyonek, and workers at oil industry facilities. Higman says some of these people helped the family with its prearranged food supply drops along the way.
I want to say thank you to all the folks who helped us out along the way. I mean, this was more so than any trip we've ever done. It was a social trip as well as a wilderness adventure, and people everywhere were just wonderful to us, and we really, really appreciate that.
He says the most technically challenging stretch of the trip was the tidal flats at the head of the inlet. With very muddy conditions all along the Susitna Delta, the family took to their 2 inflatable pack rafts to get through most of the area. Higman says fair weather and swift tidal currents made that part of the journey less difficult than it could have been. Of course, not all of the trip was sunshine and roses, though, and the family spent more than a few days holed up in a tent. On one particularly nasty day, when McKittrick's mother was along for part of the trip, 2-year-old Latuya had to resort to doing her sun dance under the rain-spattered tent.
Can you do a sun dance?
Yeah.
Okay, do a sun dance.
Oh, I want to see a sun dance.
McKittrick says it was worth it in the end when the family came to its end point at Cape Douglas, where Cook Inlet turns into Shelikoff Strait. They arrived there on a Friday, July 12th.
It was neat to see Kodiak in the view and just be like, okay, we're not in Cook Inlet anymore. We actually did go all the way around.
800 miles and 4 months around the coastline of Cook Inlet. So what did you do on your summer vacation? Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Executive Search, providing temporary or full-time staffing for over 36 years from executive and technical placement to medical and office staffing. Alaska Executive Search, online at akexec.com. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Students from the Anchorage area spent a month this summer learning how to build trails while learning about the environment and employment options. 5 agencies came together to create a 10-week outdoor career program that took students from city parks to the Chugach National Forest, clearing trees, building bridges, and cutting trails. Their latest project was at the Spencer Glacier Whistle Stop. APRN's Sarah Bernard reports.
Every morning at about 6:30, 7 students and 4 crew leaders scramble out of their tents to make breakfast and hit the trail. The one they're building, that is. It's not easy work by any means, but 18-year-old Shauna Strain says it's been an amazing summer.
I want my career to be something like this. I know I can do trail building all my life, because, like, when I'm 80, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to cut down trees anymore. But I would totally love to, like, be a park ranger or something outdoors, someone that teaches others about nature and how to, like, appreciate it more and just preserve it, because depleting, so it's like, I want to save it.
Five different agencies want to help her and other young people do just that. The Chugach National Forest, the Student Conservation Association, and others all applied for a federal cost-share grant to help put students to work in Anchorage parks, on BLM lands, and in the Chugach. Trail crew leader Lauren Sinnott says part of the attractiveness of this program is the fact that these students are all from Anchorage or nearby.
What's really exciting about this program is that it is all locally recruited, so it's a great opportunity to work with a population that is connected to the land and the environment in a more personal way.
And since most of this crew are alumni from an Anchorage-based program called Youth Employment in Parks, the idea here is not just to drop kids off in the woods for a few weeks. It's also to help them think about what it would mean to get involved with land management in the long term.
It's really a next step program. We have students that we want to be able to work for Chugach in the future or to work at the BLM, to become a park ranger in their own backyard, helping leaders become leaders, mentoring mentors.
Which Shauna Strain says is exactly what she'd like to do.
I think it's very important for youth and young adults and even kids to get out here and do this kind of stuff, because like it shows them that you don't have to always be in the office doing things that you don't like to do, because I personally hate being inside.
At Spencer Glacier, students are building the first mile and a half of what will eventually be a 17-mile trail connecting the Spencer Whistle Stop to the Grandview Whistle Stop. David Isles, Public Services Staff Officer on the Glacier Ranger District, says they definitely started from scratch.
It was raw ground when they first got here, covered in alder vegetation, dense ground to get through, and they had to do all the chainsaw work, brush clearing, the tread work, so doing the earth moving and scratching line, putting in a brand new trail.
And that was a new experience for Shauna Strain.
I could have never imagined that we're going to make a trail out of straight forest. I walk on a trail like almost every day and I didn't know what it takes. Oh, a trail, it's probably just appeared out of nowhere. But like since you actually build a trail, it's like, oh my gosh, people will have no idea like how much hard work it takes to build this trail, so I'll never look at trails the same way ever again.
Diamond High School student Noah Otto says the experience has been really worthwhile, and working outside for Otto is one of the best parts.
You look up and it's blue, you look down and it's green, and that's all you need. You know, it's hard work. You feel tired, you feel accomplished, but you can really see what you've done. I mean, in office you probably can, but I mean, I'd be more impressed with a mile of trail than a stack of papers.
Shauna Strain agrees. Just being outdoors is enough.
Personally, this is where I get my sanity back. Like, get away from all the temptations of the city, come outdoors and see what the world is really all about, I think. It's like something I'm always going to remember, and I think it's going to be like one of my favorite memories, just to say that I actually did this.
And it could be the first of many memories that Strain and her peers will make working outdoors. From Spencer Glacier, I'm Sarah Bernard.
The designer and creator of the popular line Kodiak Coats is moving on to leathers and silks and leaving Alaska. After making her trademark coats in Juneau for more than a decade, Bridget Milligan is moving to Washington State. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
On the first Friday of September in Bellingham, Bridget Milligan will be showing a new line of clothes.
I'm just going to do a splash.
For now, Milligan is looking forward to designing and making
leather coats and fancy dresses. I've always had a fantasy of just sewing with natural fabrics someday.
A van of sewing machines, fabric patterns, and other stuff has already gone south. Milligan's first Alaskan coat was created in Kodiak 25 years ago. She's originally from the San Francisco area and years ago moved to the Bristol Bay region of Alaska.
I wanted to spend the rest of my life on a camping trip, which I still want to do.
She traveled to Kodiak to have a boat built. She stayed. Milligan says her first Alaska coats were parkas for her kids made from Army-Navy blankets. Then came the Kodiak coat.
This just kind of started in my backyard, so to speak, making coats for people.
And the dory she had built became the logo for her company. The exterior fabric of a Kodiak coat is waterproofed with rubber. Each coat is lined with warm fleece, has a hood, and zips high around the neck to keep out the wind. The pockets are big and wrists adjustable, a very practical but stylish coat for the sideways rain in Alaska's coastal cities. About 15 years ago, Milligan moved her coat-making business to Juneau. That's about the time Michael Cohan and a friend bought a coat to share.
We've had the purple fleece Kodiak coat. When one of us is out of the country in Southeast Asia or some other places, we are able to use the Kodiak coat for the person who's in Alaska, and then we trade it. Whoever comes back to Alaska gets it again, so it's worked out well for us.
With word of the store closing, Cohan was looking at Milligan's line of summer dresses, tops, and skirts. But her revenue these days is coming from leather. She's even dyeing the leather for the coats herself.
And the leather coats are totally supporting me now. And I made several wedding dresses this year and bridesmaids' dresses with beautiful satins and silks and wonderful fabric.
The problem with Kodiak coats, she says, is the need to make men's, women's, and children's styles in all sizes and colors.
You just have to. You just can't say, oh, I don't make that size or I don't have that color. You just have to do that. So then maybe if you're really lucky, you get an hour a week to design something that you've been wanting to work on for 2 months.
Creating the patterns is the exciting part of the process.
But the sewing is so relaxing. It's like, now I get to sew and I can just sit and sew. It's like what I'm supposed to do.
Milligan says owning a small business requires a different mentality than working for someone else.
I call us small business owners the unemployable. So we're just lucky we've got something we can do.
Milligan has tried to close her Juneau business before, but it didn't last long, and she soon started making the practical coats again. And this time, she admits, her plans are still evolving. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Sarah Bernard reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.